were led away. Nate, as neat as ever, in an Ivy League shirt and jeans with cuffs and creases. Nate standing near the jeering, fist-shaking construction workers, but totally ignored by them. Ignored by the cops, too. Neither group knew my roommate had lately become a fan of the subversive Mr. Phil Oakes. I slipped out to the telephone booth and called Franklin Hall, second floor. Someone from the lounge answered, and when I asked for Carol, the girl said Carol wasn't there. She'd gone over to the library to study with Libby Sexton. "Is this Pete?" "Yeah," I said. "There's a note here for you. She left it on the glass." This was common practice in the dorms at that time. "It says she'll call you later." "Okay, thanks." Skip was outside the telephone booth, motioning impatiently for me to come. We walked down the hall to see Nate, even though we knew we'd both lose our places at the tables where we'd been playing. In this case, curiosity outweighed obsession. Nate's face didn't change much when we showed him the paper and asked him about the demonstration the day before, but his face never changed much. All the same, I sensed that he was unhappy, perhaps even miserable. I couldn't understand why that would be. Everything had ended well, after all. No one had gone to jail or even been named in the paper. I just about decided I was reading too much into his usual quietness when Skip said, "What's eating you?" There was a kind of rough concern in his voice. Nate's lower lip trembled and then firmed at the sound of it. He leaned over the neat surface of his desk. My own was already covered in about 19 layers of junk, and snagged a Kleenex from the box he kept by his record player. He blew his nose long and hard. When he was finished, he was under control again, but I could see the baffled unhappiness in his eyes. Part of me, a mean part, was glad to see it. Glad to know that you didn't have to turn into a hearts junkie to have problems. Human nature can be so shitty sometimes. I rode up with Stoke and Harry Swidrowski and a few other guys, Nate said. "Was Carol with you?" I asked. Nate shook his head. "I think she was with George Gilman's bunch. There were 5 carloads of us in all." I didn't know George Gilman from Adam, but that did not prevent me from directing a dart of fairly sick jealousy at him. "Harry and Stoke are on the Committee of Resistance. Gilman, too. Anyway, we..." "Committee of Resistance?" Skip asked. "What's that?" "A club," Nate said and sighed. "They think it's something more, especially Harry and George. They're real firebrands. But it's just another club, really, like the Main Mask or the Pep Squad." Nate said he himself had gone along because it was a Tuesday and he didn't have any classes on Tuesday afternoons. No one gave orders. No one passed around loyalty oaths or even sign-up sheets. There was no real pressure to march, and none of the paramilitary beret-wearing fervor that crept into the anti-war movement later on. Carol and the kids with her had been laughing and bopping each other with their signs when they left the gym parking lot, according to Nate. Laughing. Laughing with George Gilman. I threw another of those germ-laden jealousy darts. When they got to the federal building, some people demonstrated, marching around in circles in front of the Selective Service office door, and some people didn't. Nate was one of those who didn't. As he told us that, his usually smooth face tightened in another brief cramp of something that might have been real misery in a less settled boy. "I meant to march with them," he said. "All the way up, I expected to march with them. It was exciting. 6 of us crammed into Harry Swidrowski's Saab. A real trip. Hunter McPhail, do you guys know him?" Skip and I shook our heads. I think both of us were a little awestruck to discover the owner of Meet Trini Lopez and Diane Renee Sings Navy Blue had what amounted to a secret life, including connections to the sort of people who attracted both cops and newspaper coverage. He and George Gilman started the committee. Anyway, Hunter was holding Stokes' crutches out the window of the Saab because we couldn't fit them inside, and we sang, "I Ain't Marching Anymore," and talked about how maybe we could really stop the war if enough of us got together. That is, all of us talked about stuff like that except Stoke. He keeps pretty quiet. So, I thought, even with them, he keeps quiet. except presumably when he decides a little credibility lecture is in order. But Nate wasn't thinking about Stoke. Nate was thinking about Nate, brooding over his feet's inexplicable refusal to carry his heart where it had clearly wanted to go. All the way up, I'm thinking, I'll march with them. I'll march with them because it's right. At least, I think it's right. And if someone takes a swing at me, I'll be nonviolent, just like the guys in the lunchroom sit-ins. Those guys won, maybe we can win, too. He looked at us. I mean, it was never a question in my mind, you know? Yeah, Skip said. I know. But when we got there, I couldn't do it. I helped hand out signs saying stop the war and U.S. out of Vietnam now and bring the boys home. Carol and I helped Stoke fix his so he could march with it and still use his crutches, but I couldn't take one myself. I stood on the sidewalk with Bill Shadwick and Carrie Morin and a girl named Lorelei McGinnis. She's my partner in botany lab. He took the sheet of newspaper out of Skip's hand and studied it, as if to confirm again that, yes, it had all really happened. The master of Rinty and the boyfriend of Cindy had actually gone to an anti-war demonstration. He sighed and then let the piece of newspaper drift to the floor. This was so unlike him, it kind of hurt my head. I thought I would march with them. I mean, why else did I come? All the way down from Orono, it was never, you know, a question in my mind. He looked at me, kind of pleading. I nodded as if I understood. But then I didn't. I don't know why. Skip sat down next to him on his bed. I found the Phil Oakes album and put it on the turntable. Nate looked at Skip, then looked away. Nate's hands were as small and neat as the rest of him, except for the nails. The nails were ragged, bitten right down to the quick. Okay, he said, as if Skip had asked out loud. I do know why. I was afraid they'd get arrested, and I'd get arrested with them. That my picture would be in the paper getting arrested and my folks would see it. There was a long pause. Poor old Nady was trying to say the rest. I held the needle over the first groove of the spinning record, waiting to see if he could. At last, he did. That my mother would see it. It's okay, Nate, Skip said. I don't think so, Nate replied in a trembling voice. I really don't. He wouldn't meet Skip's eyes, only sat there on his bed with his prominent chicken ribs and bare white Yankee skin between his pajama bottoms and his freshman beanie, looking down at his gnawed cuticles. I don't like to argue about the war. Harry does, and Lorelei, George Gilman, gosh, you can't get George to shut up about it, and most of the others on the committee are the same. But when it comes to talking, I'm more like Stoke than them. No one's like Stoke, I said. I remembered the day I met him on Bennett's Walk. Why don't you take it easy, I'd asked. Why don't you eat me, Mr. Credibility had replied. Nate was still studying his cuticles. What I think is that Johnson is sending American boys over there to die for no reason. It isn't imperialism or colonialism like Harry Swiderowski believes. It's not any ism at all. Johnson's got it all mixed up in his mind with Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone and the New York Yankees, that's all. And if I think that, I ought to say that. I ought to try to stop it. That's what I learned in church, in school, even in the darn Boy Scouts of America. You're supposed to stand up. If you see something happening that's wrong, like a big guy beating up a little guy, you're supposed to stand up and at least try to stop it. But I was afraid my mother'd see a picture of me getting arrested and cry. Nate raised his head and we saw he was crying himself, just a little, wet lids and lashes, no more than that. For him it was a big deal, though. I found out one thing, he said. What that is on the back of Stoke Jones's jacket. What? Skip asked. A combination of two British Navy semaphore letters. Look. Nate stood up with his bare heels together. He lifted his left arm straight up toward the ceiling and dropped his right down to the floor, making a straight line. That's N. Next, he held his arms out at 45-degree angles to his body. I could see how the two shapes, when superimposed, would make the shape Stoke had inked on the back of his old duffel coat. This one's D. N-D, Skip said. So? The letters stand for nuclear disarmament. Bertrand Russell invented the symbol in the 50s. He drew it on the back of his notebook. He called it a peace sign. Cool, Skip said. Nate smiled and wiped under his eyes with his fingers. That's what I thought, he agreed. It's a groove thing. I dropped the needle on the record, and we listened to Phil Oakes sing, "Groove to It," as we Atlanteans used to say. The lounge in the middle of Chamberlain 3 had become my Jupiter, a scary planet with a huge gravitational pull. Still, I resisted it that night, slipping back into the phone booth instead and calling Franklin again. This time, I got Carol. "I'm all right," she said, laughing a little. "I'm fine. One of the cops even called me Little Lady." "Sheesh, Pete, such concern." "How much concern did this guy Gilman show you?" I felt like asking. But even at 18, I knew that wasn't the way to go. "You should have given me a call," I said. "Maybe I would have gone with you. We could have taken my car." Carol began to giggle, a sweet sound, but puzzling. "What?" "I was thinking about riding to an anti-war demonstration in a station wagon with a Goldwater sticker on the bumper." I guess that was sort of funny. "Besides," she said, "I imagine you had other things to do." "What's that supposed to mean?" As if I didn't know. Through the glass of the phone booth and that of the lounge, I could see most of my floor mates playing cards in a fume of cigarette smoke. And even in here, with the door closed, I could hear Ronnie Malenfant's high-pitched cackle. "We're chasing the bitch, boys. We are churchaying la cunt noire, and we're going to have her out of the bushes." "Studying her hearts," she said. "Studying, I hope. One of the girls on my floor goes out with Lenny Doria, or did when he still had time to go out. She calls it the card game from hell. Am I being a nag yet?" "No," I said, not knowing if she was or not. Maybe I needed to be nagged. "Carol, are you okay?" There was a long pause. "Yeah," she said at last. "Sure I am. The construction workers who showed up, mostly mouths," she said. "Don't worry, really." But she didn't sound right to me, not quite right, and there was George Gilman to worry about. I worried about him in a way I didn't about Sully, the boyfriend back home. "Are you on this committee Nate told me about?" I asked her. "This committee of resistance, what's it?" "No," she said. "Not yet, at least. George has asked me to join. He's this guy from my poli-sci course. George Gilman, do you know him?" "Heard of him," I said. I was clutching the phone too tightly and couldn't seem to loosen up. "He was the one who told me about the demonstration. I rode up with him and some others. I..." She broke off for a moment, then said with honest curiosity, "You're not jealous of him, are you?" "Well," I said carefully, "he got to spend an afternoon with you. I'm jealous of that, I guess." "Don't be. He's got brains, plenty of them, but he's also got a whiffle haircut and great big shifty eyes. He shaves, but it seems like he always misses a big patch. He's not the attraction, believe me." "Then what is?" "Can I see you? I want to show you something. It won't take long, but it might help if I could just explain..." Her voice wavered on the word, and I realized she was close to tears. "What's wrong?" "You mean, other than that my father probably won't let me back into his house once he's seen me in the news? He'll have the locks changed by this weekend, I'll bet. That's if he hasn't changed them already. I thought of Nate saying he was afraid his mother would see a picture of him getting arrested. Mommy's good little pre-dent pinched down in Derry for parading in front of the federal building without a permit. Ah, the shame, the shame. And Carol's dad? Not quite the same deal, but close. Carol's dad was a steady boy who said ship ahoy and joined the Navy, after all. He may not see the story, I said. Even if he does, the paper didn't use any names. The picture. She spoke patiently, as if to someone who can't help being dense. Didn't you see the picture? I started to say that her face was mostly turned away from the camera, and what you could see was in shadow. Then I remembered her high school jacket with Harwich High School blaring across the back. Also, he was her father, for Christ's sake. Even half turned away from the camera, he would know her. He may not see the picture either, I said lamely. Damerscott is at the far edge of the news's area. Is that how you want to live your life, Pete? She still sounded patient, but now it was patience with an edge. Doing stuff and then hoping people won't find out? No, I said. And could I get mad at her for saying that, considering that Anne-Marie Soucy still didn't have the slightest idea that Carol Gerber was alive? I didn't think so. Anne-Marie and I weren't married or anything, but marriage wasn't the issue. No, I don't. But Carol, you don't have to shove the damn newspaper under his nose for him, do you? She laughed. The sound had none of the brightness I had heard in her earlier giggle, but I thought even a rueful laugh was better than none at all. I won't have to. He'll find it. That's just the way he is. But I had to go, Pete. And I'll probably join the Committee of Resistance, even though George Gilman always looks like a little kid who just got caught eating boogers and Harry Swidrowski has the world's worst breath. Because it's... the thing of it is... you see... She blew a frustrated, I-can't-explain sigh into my ear. Listen, you know where we go out for smoke breaks? At Holyoke? By the dumpster, sure. Meet me there, Carol said. In 15 minutes, can you? Yes. I have a lot more studying to do, so I can't stay long, but I'll be there. I hung up the phone and stepped out of the booth. Ashley Rice was standing in the doorway of the lounge, smoking and doing a little shuffle step. I deduced that he was between games. His face was too pale, the black stubble on his cheek standing out like pencil marks, and his shirt had gone beyond simply soiled. It looked lived in. He had a wide-eyed danger, high-voltage look that I later came to associate with heavy cocaine users. And that's what the game really was, a kind of drug. Not the kind that mellowed you out, either. What do you say, Pete? He asked. Want to play a few hands? Maybe later, I said, and started down the hall. Stoke Jones was thumping back from the bathroom in an old frayed robe. His crutches left round tracks on the linoleum. His hair was wet, crazier than ever. I wondered how he did in the shower. Certainly there were none of the railings and grab handles that later became standard in public washing facilities. He didn't look as though he would much enjoy discussing the subject, however. That or any other subject. How you doing, Stoke? I asked. He went by without answering. Head down, dripping hair plastered to his cheeks, soap and towel clamped under one arm, muttering rip, 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 rip under his breath. He never even looked up at me. Say whatever you wanted about Stoke Jones. You could depend on him to put a little fuck you into your day. Carol was already at Holyoke when I got there. She had brought a couple of milk boxes from the area where the dumpsters were lined up and was sitting on one of them, legs crossed, smoking a cigarette. I sat down on the other one, put my arm around her, and kissed her. She put her head on my shoulder for a moment, not saying anything. This wasn't much like her, but it was nice. I kept my arm around her and looked up at the stars. The night was mild for so late in the season, and lots of people, couples mostly, were out walking, taking advantage of the weather. I could hear their murmured conversations. From above us, in the Commons dining room, a radio was playing Hang On Sloopy. One of the janitors, I suppose. Carol raised her head at last and moved away from me a little, just enough to let me know I could take my arm back. That was more like her, actually. "Thanks," she said. "I needed a hug." "My pleasure. I'm a little scared about facing my dad. Not real scared, but a little. It'll be all right. Not saying it because I really thought it would be. I couldn't know a thing like that. But because it's what you say, isn't it? Just what you say. My dad's not the reason I went with Harry and George and the rest. It's no big Freudian rebellion or anything like that." She flicked her cigarette away, and we watched it fountain sparks when it struck the bricks of Bennett's Walk. Then she took her little clutch purse out of her lap, opened it, found her wallet, opened that, and thumbed through a selection of snapshots stuck in those small celluloid windows. She stopped, slipped one out, and handed it to me. I leaned forward so I could see it by the light falling through the dining hall windows, where the janitors were probably doing the floors. The picture showed three kids of 11 or 12, a girl and two boys. They were all wearing blue T-shirts with the words Sterling House on them in red block letters. They were standing in a parking lot somewhere and had their arms around each other, an easy pals forever pose that was sort of beautiful. The girl was in the middle. The girl was Carol, of course. "Which one is Sully John?" I asked. She looked at me a little surprised, but with a smile. In any case, I thought, I already knew. Sully John would be the one with the broad shoulders, the wide grin, and the tumbled black hair. It reminded me of Stokes' hair, although the boy had obviously run a comb through his thatch. I tapped him. "This one, right?" "That's Sully," she agreed, then touched the face of the other boy with her fingernail. He had a sunburn rather than a tan. His face was narrower, the eyes a little closer together, the hair a carroty red and mowed in a crew cut that made him look like a kid on a Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post cover. There was a faint frown line on his brow. Sully's arms were already muscular for a kid's. This other boy had thin arms, thin stick arms. They were probably still thin stick arms. On the hand not slung around Carol's shoulders, he was wearing a big brown baseball glove. "This one's Bobby," she said. Her voice had changed somehow. There was something in it I'd never heard before. Sorrow. But she was still smiling. If it was sorrow she felt, why was she smiling? "Bobby Garfield. He was my first boyfriend, my first love, I guess you could say. He and Sully and I were best friends back then. Not so long ago, 1960, but it seems long ago." "What happened to him?" I was somehow sure she was going to tell me he had died, this boy with the narrow face and the crew-cut carrot top. "He and his mom moved away. We wrote back and forth for a while, and then we lost touch. You know how kids are. Nice baseball glove." Carol, still with the smile. I could see the tears that had come into her eyes as we sat looking down at the snapshot, but still with the smile. In the white light of the fluorescence from the dining hall, her tears looked silver, the tears of a princess in a fairy tale. That was Bobby's favorite thing. There's a baseball player named Alvin Dark, right? There was. That's what kind of a glove Bobby had, an Alvin Dark model. Mine was a Ted Williams. I think my mom rummage sailed it a couple of years ago. "Bobby's got stolen," Carol said. I'm not sure she knew I was there anymore. She kept touching that narrow, slightly frowning face with her fingertip. It was as if she had regressed into her own past. I've heard that hypnotists can do that with good subjects. Willie took it. Willie? Willie Shearman. I saw him playing ball with it a year later, down at Sterling House. I was so mad. My mom and dad were always fighting then, working up to the divorce, I guess, and I was mad all the time. Mad at them, mad at my math teacher, mad at the whole world. I was still scared of Willie, but mostly I was mad at him. And besides, I wasn't by myself, not that day. So I marched right up to him, and I said I knew that was Bobby's glove, and he ought to give it to me. I said I had Bobby's address in Massachusetts, and I'd send it to him. Willie said I was crazy. It was his glove, and he showed me his name on the side. He'd erased Bobby's, best as he could anyway, and printed his own over where it had been, but I could still see the BBY from Bobby. A creepy sort of indignation had crept into her voice. It made her sound younger, and look younger. I suppose my memory could be wrong about that, but I don't think it is. Sitting there on the edge of the white light from the dining hall, I think she looked about 12, 13 at the most. He couldn't erase the Alvin Dark signature in the pocket, though, or right over it. And he blushed. Dark red, red as roses. Then, do you know what? He apologized for what he and his two friends did to me. He was the only one who ever did, and I think he meant it. But he lied about the glove. I don't think he wanted it. It was old, and the webbing was all broken out, and it looked all wrong on his hand. But he lied so he could keep it. I don't understand why. I never have. I'm not following this, I said. Why should you? It's all jumbled up in my mind, and I was there. My mother told me once that happens to people who are in accidents or fights. I remember some of it pretty well, mostly the parts with Bobby in them. But almost everything else comes from what people told me later on. I was in the park, down the street from my house, and these three boys came along. Harry Doolin, Willie Shearman, and another one. I can't remember the other one's name. It doesn't matter anyway. They beat me up. I was only 11, but that didn't stop them. Harry Doolin hit me with a baseball bat. Willie and the other one held me so I couldn't run away. A baseball bat? Are you shitting me? She shook her head. At first they were joking, I think, and then... they weren't. My arm got dislocated. I screamed, and I guess they ran away. I sat there holding my arm, too hurt and too shocked, I guess, to know what to do. Or maybe I tried to get up and get help for myself and couldn't. Then Bobby came along. He walked me out of the park, and then he picked me up and he carried me back to his apartment. All the way up Broad Street Hill on one of the hottest days of the year, he carried me in his arms. I took the snapshot from her, held it in the light, and bent over it, looking at the boy with the crew cut, looking at his thin stick arms, then looking at the girl. She was an inch or two taller than he was, and broader in the shoulders. I looked at the other boy, Sully, he of the tumbled black hair and the all-American grin, Stoke Jones's hair, Skip Kirk's grin. I could see Sully carrying her in his arms. Yeah, but the other kid. I know, she said. He doesn't look big enough, does he? But he carried me. I started to faint, and he carried me. She took the picture back. And while he was doing that, this kid Willie, who helped beat you up, came back and stole his glove? She nodded. Bobby took me to his apartment. There was this old guy who lived in a room upstairs, Ted, who seemed to know a little bit about everything. He popped my arm back into its socket. I remember he gave me his belt to bite on when he did it, or maybe it was Bobby's belt. He said I could catch the pain, and I did. After that something bad happened. Worse than getting lumped up with a baseball bat? In a way. I don't want to talk about it. She wiped her tears away with one hand, first one side and then the other, still looking at the snapshot. Later on, before he and his mother left Harwich, Bobby beat up the boy who actually used the bat, Harry Doolin. Carol put her photograph back in its little compartment. What I remember best about that day, the only thing about it worth remembering, is that Bobby Garfield stood up for me. Sully was bigger, and Sully might have stood up for me if he'd been there, but he wasn't. Bobby was there, and he carried me all the way up the hill. He did what was right. It's the best thing, the most important thing, anyone has ever done for me in my life. Do you see that, Pete? Yeah, I do. I saw something else, too. She was saying almost exactly what Nate had said not an hour before. Only she had marched, had taken one of the signs and marched with it. Of course, Nate Hoppenstand had never been beaten up by three boys who started out joking and then decided they were serious, and maybe that was the difference. "He carried me up that hill," she said. "I always wanted to tell him how much I loved him for that, and how much I loved him for showing Harry Doolin that there's a price to pay for hurting people, especially people who are smaller than you and don't mean you any harm." "So you marched?" "I marched. I wanted to tell someone why. I wanted to tell someone who'd understand. My father won't, and my mother can't. Her friend Rionda called me and said..." She didn't finish, only sat there on the milk box, fidgeting with her little bag. "Said what?" "Nothing." She sounded exhausted, forlorn. I wanted to kiss her, at least put my arm around her, but I was afraid doing either would spoil what had just happened. Because something had happened. There was magic in her story. Not in the middle, but somewhere out around the edges. I felt it. I marched, and I guess I'll join the Committee of Resistance. My roommate says I'm crazy. I'll never get a job if a commie student group's part of my college records, but I think I'm going to do it. And your father? What about him? Fuck him. There was a semi-shocked moment when we considered what she had just said, and then Carol giggled. Now that's Freudian. She stood up. I have to go back and study. Thanks for coming out, Pete. I haven't ever shown that picture to anyone. I haven't looked at it myself in who knows how long. I feel better. Lots. Good. I got up myself. Before you go in, will you help me do something?
Sure, what?
I'll show you. It won't take long. I walked her down the side of Holyoke, and then we started up the hill behind it. About 200 yards away was the steam plant parking lot, where undergrads ineligible for parking stickers, freshmen, sophomores, and most juniors, had to keep their cars. It was the prime makeout spot on campus once it got cold, but making out in my car wasn't on my mind that night. "Did you ever tell Bobby about who got his baseball glove?" I asked. "You said you wrote to him." "I didn't see the point." We walked in silence for a little while. Then I said, "I'm going to call it off with Anne-Marie over Thanksgiving." I started to phone her, then didn't. If I'm going to do it, I guess I better find the guts to do it face to face. I hadn't been aware of coming to any such decision, not consciously, but it seemed I had. Certainly it wasn't something I was saying just to please Carol. She nodded, scuffing through the leaves in her sneakers, holding her little bag in one hand, not looking at me. I had to use the phone, called S.J. and told him I was seeing a guy. I stopped.
"When?"
"Last week." Now she looked up at me, dimples, slightly curved lower lip, the smile.
"Last week? And you didn't tell me?"
"It was my business," she said, "mine and Sully's. I mean, it isn't like he's going to come after you with a..." She paused long enough for both of us to think,
"with a baseball bat."
And then went on, "that he's going to come after you or anything. Come on, Pete. If we're going to do something, let's do it. I'm not going riding with you, though. I really have to study."
"No rides."
We got walking again. The steam plant lot seemed huge to me in those days. Hundreds of cars parked in dozens of moonlit rows. I could hardly ever remember where I left my brother's old Ford wagon. The last time I was back at UM, the lot was 3, maybe even 4 times as big, with space for 1,000 cars or more. Time passes and everything gets bigger except us. "Hey, Pete?" Walking. Looking down at her sneakers again, even though we were on asphalt now and there were no more leaves to scuff.
"Uh-huh."
"I don't want you to go breaking up with Anne-Marie because of me. Because I have an idea where... temporary. All right?" "Yeah." What she said made me unhappy. It was what the citizens of Atlantis referred to as a bummer, but it didn't really surprise me. I guess it'll have to be. "I like you, and I like being with you now, but it's just liking you, that's all it is, and it's best to be honest.
so if you want to keep your mouth shut when you go home for the holiday. Kind of keep her around at home, sort of like a spare tire in case we get a flat here at school. She looked startled, then laughed. Touché, she said. Touché for what? I don't even know, Pete, but I do like you. She stopped, turned to me, slipped her arms around my neck. We kissed for a little while between the two rows of cars. Kissed until I got a pretty decent bone on, one I'm sure she could feel. Then she gave me a final peck on the lips, and we started walking again. What did Sully say when you told him? I don't know if I'm supposed to ask, but... But you want information, she said in a brusque number two voice. Then she laughed. It was the rueful one. I was expecting he'd be angry, or that he might even cry. Sully's big, and he scares the devil out of the football players he matches up against, but his feelings are always close to the skin. What I didn't expect was relief. Relief? Relief. He's been seeing this girl in Bridgeport for a month or more, except my mom's friend Rhonda told me she's actually a woman, maybe 24 or 25. Sounds like a recipe for disaster, I said, hoping I sounded measured and thoughtful. I was actually delighted. Of course I was. And if poor old gosh-darn tender-hearted John Sullivan stumbled into the plot of a country-western Merle Haggard song, well, 400 million red Chinese wouldn't give a shit, and that went double for me. We had almost arrived at my car. It was just one more old heap among all the others, but, courtesy of my brother, it was mine. He's got more on his mind than his new love interest, Carol said. He's going into the army when he finishes high school next June. He's already talked to the recruiter and got it arranged. He can't wait to get over there in Vietnam and start making the world safe for democracy. Did you have a fight with him about the war? Nope. What would be the use? For that matter, what would I tell him? That for me it's all about Bobby Garfield? That all the stuff Harry Swiderowski and George Gilman and Hunter McPhail say seems like smoke and mirrors compared to Bobby carrying me up Broad Street Hill? Sully would think I was crazy. Or say it's because I'm too smart. Sully feels sorry for people who are too smart. He says being too smart is a disease. And maybe he's right. I kind of love him, you know. He's sweet. He's also the kind of guy who needs someone to take care of him. And I hope he finds someone, I thought, just as long as it's not you. She looked judiciously at my car. Okay, she said. It's ugly. It desperately needs a wash, but it's transportation. The question is, what are we doing here when I should be reading a Flannery O'Connor story? I took out my pocket knife and opened it. Got a nail file in your bag? As a matter of fact, I do. Are we going to fight? Number two and number six go at it in the steam plant parking lot? Don't be a smartass. Just get it out and follow me. By the time we got around to the back of the station wagon, she was laughing. Not the rueful laugh, but the full-out guffaw I'd first heard when Skip's horny hot dog man came down the dishline conveyor belt. She finally understood why we were here. Carol took one side of the bumper sticker. I took the other. We met in the middle. Then we watched the shreds blow away across the macadam. Au revoir, AUH2O for USA. Bye-bye, Barry. And we laughed. Man, we just couldn't stop laughing. A couple of days later, my friend Skip, who'd come to college with the political awareness of a mollusk, put up a poster on his side of the room he shared with Brad Witherspoon. It showed a smiling businessman in a three-piece suit. One hand was extended to shake. The other was hidden behind his back, but something clutched in it was dripping blood between his shoes. War is good business, the poster said. Invest your son. Deary was horrified. So you're against Vietnam now? He asked when he saw it. Below his chin-out truculence, I think our beloved floor proctor was badly shocked by that poster. Skip, after all, had been a first-class high school baseball player, was expected to play college ball, too, had been courted by both Delta Tau Delta and Phi Gam, the jock frats. Skip was no sickly cripple like Stoke Jones. Deary Dearborn had also taken to calling Stoke, Rip-Rip, No frog-eyed weirdo like George Gilman. Hey, all this poster means is that a lot of people are making money out of a big bloody mess, Skip said. McDonnell Douglas, Boeing, GE, Dow Chemical and Coleman Chemicals, Pepsi fucking Cola, lots more. Deary's gimlet gaze conveyed, or tried to, the idea that he had thought about such issues more deeply than Skip Kirk ever could. Let me ask you something. Do you think we should just stand back and let Uncle Ho take over down there? I don't know what I think, Skip said. Not yet. I only started getting interested in the subject a couple of weeks ago. I'm still playing catch-up. This was at 7:30 in the morning, and a little group outbound for 8 o'clock classes had gathered around Skip's door. I saw Ronnie, plus Nick Prouty. By this point, the two of them had become inseparable. Ashley Rice, Lenny Doria, Billy Marchant, maybe four or five others. Nate was leaning in the doorway of 302, wearing a T-shirt and his PJ bottoms. In the stairwell, Stoke Jones leaned on his crutches. He had apparently been on his way out and had turned back to monitor the discussion. Deary said, "When the Viet Cong come into a South Viet Ville, the first thing they look for are people wearing crucifixes, St. Christopher medals, Mary medals, anything of that nature. Catholics are killed. People who believe in God are killed. Do you think we should stand back while the commies kill people who believe in God?" "Why not?" Stoke said from the stairwell. "We stood back and let the Nazis kill the Jews for 6 years. Jews believe in God, or so I'm told." "Fucking rip-rip," Ronnie shouted. "Who the fuck asked you to play the piano?" But by then, Stoke Jones, a.k.a. Rip-Rip, was making his way down the stairs. The echoey sound of his crutches made me think of the recently departed Frank Stewart. Deary turned back to Skip. His hands were fisted on his hips. Lying against the front of his white T-shirt was a set of dog tags. His father had worn them in France and Germany, he told us, had been wearing them as he lay behind a tree, hiding from the machine gun fire that had killed 2 men in his company and wounded 4 more. What this had to do with the Vietnam conflict, none of us quite knew, but it was clearly a big deal to Deary, so none of us asked. Even Ronnie had sense enough to keep his trap shut. "If we let them take South Vietnam, they'll take Cambodia." Deary's eyes moved from Skip to me to Ronnie to all of us. "Then Laos, then the Philippines, one after the other." "If they can do that, maybe they deserve to win," I said. Deary looked at me, shocked. I was sort of shocked myself, but I didn't take it back. There was one more round of prelims before the Thanksgiving break, and for the young scholars of Chamberlain III, it was a disaster. By then, most of us understood that we were a disaster, that we were committing a kind of group suicide. Kirby McClendon did his freak-out thing and disappeared like a rabbit in a magic trick. Kenny Auster, who usually sat in the corner during the marathon games and picked his nose when he couldn't decide what card to play next, simply bugged out one day. He left a queen of spades with the words, "I quit," written across it on his pillow. George Lessard joined Steve Ogg and Jack Frady in Chad, the brain dorm. 6 down, 13 to go. It should have been enough. Hell, just what happened to poor old Kirby should have been enough. In the last 3 or 4 days before he freaked, his hands were trembling so badly he had trouble picking up his cards, and he jumped in his seat if someone slammed a door in the hall. Kirby should have been enough, but he wasn't. Nor was my time with Carol the answer. When I was actually with her, yes, I was fine. When I was with her, all I wanted was information, and maybe to bawl her socks off. When I was in the dorm, though, especially in that goddamn third-floor lounge, I became another version of Peter Riley. In the third-floor lounge, I was a stranger to myself. As Thanksgiving approached, a kind of blind fatalism set in. None of us talked about it, though. We talked about the movies, or sex.
I get more ass than a merry-go-round pony, Ronnie used to crow, usually with no warning or conversational lead-in of any kind.
But mostly we talked about Vietnam, and hearts. Our hearts discussions were about who was ahead, who was behind, and who couldn't seem to master the few simple strategic ploys of the game. Void yourself in at least one suit. Pass mid-range hearts to someone who likes to shoot the moon. If you have to take a trick, always take it high. Our only real response to the looming third round of prelims was to organize the game into a kind of endless revolving tournament. We were still playing Nicola Point, but we were now also playing for match points. The system for awarding match points was quite complex, but Randy Eccles and Hugh Brennan worked out a good formula in two feverish late-night sessions. Both of them, incidentally, were flunking their introductory math courses. Neither was invited back at the conclusion of the fall semester. 33 years have passed since that pre-Thanksgiving round of exams, and the man that boy became still winces at the memory of them. I flunked everything but sociology and intro English. I didn't have to see the grades to know it, either. Skip said he'd flagged the board except for calc, and there he barely squeaked by. I was taking Carol out to a movie that night, our one pre-break date, and our last, although I didn't know that then, and saw Ronnie Malenfant on my way to get my car. I asked him how he thought he'd done on his tests. Ronnie smiled and winked and said, "Aced everything, champ, just like on fucking College Bowl. I'm not worried." But in the light of the parking lot, I could see his smile wavering minutely at the corners. His skin was too pale, and his acne, bad when we started school in September, was worse than ever.
"How about you?"
"They're going to make me Dean of Arts and Sciences," I said. "That tell you anything?" Ronnie burst out laughing.
"You fucking pisspot."
He clapped me on the shoulder. The cocky look in his eyes had been replaced by fright that made him look younger.
"Going out?"
"Yeah."
"Carol?"
"Yeah."
"Good for you. She's a great-looking chick."
For Ronnie, this was nearly heart-rending sincerity. "And if I don't see you in the lounge later on, have a great turkey day."
"You too, Ronnie."
"Yeah."
"Sure."
Looking at me from the corners of his eyes rather than straight on, trying to hold the smile.
"One way or another, I guess we're both going to eat the bird, wouldn't you say?"
"Yeah, I guess that pretty well sums it up." It was hot. Even with the engine off and the heater off, it was hot. We had warmed up the whole inside of the car with our bodies. The windows steamed so that the light from the parking lot came in all diffused, like light through a pebbled glass bathroom window, and the radio was on. Mighty John Marshall making with the oldies, the humble yet nonetheless mighty playing the Four Seasons and the Dovells, and Jack Scott and Little Richard and Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, all those oldies. And her sweater was open and her bra was draped over the seat with one strap hanging down. A thick white strap, bra technology in those days hadn't yet taken that next great leap forward. And oh man, her skin was warm, her nipple rough in my mouth, and she still had her panties on, but only sort of. They were all pushed and bunched to one side, and I had first one finger in her, and then two fingers, Chuck Berry singing Johnny B. Goode and the Royal Teens singing Short Shorts, and her hand was inside my fly, fingers pulling at the elastic of my own short shorts, and I could smell her, the perfume on her neck and the sweat on her temples just below where her hair started, and I could hear her, hear the live pulse of her breath, wordless whispers in my mouth as we kissed, all of this with the front seat of my car pushed back as far as it would go, me not thinking of flunk prelims or the war in Vietnam or LBJ wearing a lei or hearts or anything, only wanting her. Wanting her right here and right now. And then, suddenly, she was straightening up and straightening me up, both hands planted on my chest, splayed fingers pushing me back toward the steering wheel. I moved toward her again, slipping one of my own hands up her thigh, and she said, "Pete, no," in a sharp voice, and closed her legs, the knees coming together loud enough so I could hear the sound they made, that locking sound that means you're done making out, like it or not.
I didn't like it, but I stopped.
I leaned my head back against the fogged-up window on the driver's side, breathing hard. My cock was an iron bar stuffed down the front of my underwear, so hard it hurt. That would go away soon enough. No hard-on lasts forever. I think Benjamin Disraeli said that. But even after the erection's gone, the blue balls linger on. It's just a fact of guy life. We had left the movie, some really terrible good old boy thing with Burt Reynolds in it, early and had come back to the steam plant parking lot with the same thing on our minds. Or so I'd hoped. I guess it was the same thing, except I had been hoping for a little more of it than I'd gotten. Carol had pulled the sides of her sweater together, but her bra still hung over the back of the seat, and she looked madly desirable, with her breasts trying to tumble out through the gap and half an aureola visible in the dim light. She had a purse open and was fumbling her cigarettes out with shaky hands. "Whew," she said. Her voice was as shaky as her hands. "I mean, holy cow." "You look like Brigitte Bardot with your sweater open like that," I told her. She looked up, surprised and, I thought, pleased. "Do you really think so, or is it just the blonde hair?" "The hair? Shit, no. Mostly it's..." I gestured toward her front. She looked down at herself and laughed. She didn't do the buttons, though, or try to pull the sides any more closely together. I'm not sure she could have, anyway. As I remember, that sweater was a wonderfully tight fit. There was a theater up the street from us when I was a kid, the Asher Empire. It's torn down now, but when we were kids, Bobby and Sully John and me, it seemed they were always showing her pictures. I think that one of them, And God Created Woman, must have played there for about 1,000 years. I burst out laughing and took my own cigarettes off the dashboard. That was always the third feature at the Gates Falls drive-in on Friday and Saturday nights. Did you ever see it? Are you kidding? I wasn't even allowed to go to the drive-in unless it was a Disney double feature. I think I must have seen Tonka with Sal Mineo at least 7 times. But I remember the previews. Brigitte and her towel. "I'm not coming back to school," she said, and lit her cigarette. She spoke so calmly that at first I thought we were still talking about old movies, or Midnight in Calcutta, or whatever it took to persuade our bodies that it was time to go back to sleep. The action was over. Then it clicked in my head. Did you say..." "I said I'm not coming back after break, and it's not going to be much of a Thanksgiving at home as far as that goes, but what the hell? Your father?" She shook her head, drawing on her cigarette. In the light of its coal, her face was all orange highlights and crescents of gray shadow. She looked older, still beautiful, but older. On the radio, Paul Anka was singing Diana. I snapped it off. "My father's got nothing to do with it. I'm going back to Harwich. Do you remember me mentioning my mother's friend, Rhonda?" I sort of did, so I nodded. "Rhonda took the picture I showed you, the one of me with Bobby and S.J. She says..." Carol looked down at her skirt, which was still hiked most of the way to her waist, and began plucking at it. "You can never tell what's going to embarrass people. Sometimes it's toilet functions. Sometimes it's the sexual hijinks of relatives. Sometimes it's show-off behavior. And sometimes, of course, it's drink. Let's put it this way. My dad's not the only one in the Gerber family with a booze problem. He taught my mother how to tip her elbow, and she was a good student. For a long time, she laid off. She went to AA meetings, I think. But Rhonda says she started again, so I'm going home. I don't know if I can take care of her or not, but I'm going to try. For my brother as much as my mother. Rhonda says Ian doesn't know if he's coming or going. Of course, he never did." She smiled. "Carol, that's maybe not such a good idea, to shoot your education that way." She looked up angrily. "You want to talk about shooting my education? You know what I'm hearing about that fucking hearts game on Chamberlain 3 these days? That everyone on the floor is going to flunk out by Christmas, including you. Penny Lang says that by the start of spring semester there won't be anyone left up there but that shithead proctor of yours." "Nah," I said. "That's an exaggeration. Nate'll be left. Stokely Jones, too, if he doesn't break his neck going downstairs some night." You act as though it's funny, she said.
It's not funny, I said. No, it wasn't funny.
Then why don't you quit it?
Now I was the one starting to feel angry. She had pushed me away and clapped her knees shut, had told me she was going away just when I was starting to not only want her around, but need her around. She had left me with what was soon going to be a world-class case of blue balls. And now it was all about me. Now it was all about cards.
I don't know why I don't quit it, I said. Why don't you find someone else to take care of your mother? Why doesn't this friend of hers, Rionda, take care of her? I mean, is it your fault your mother's a lush?
My mother is not a lush. Don't you call her that.
Well, she's sure something if you're going to drop out of college on her account. If it's that serious, Carol, it's sure something.
Rionda has a job and a mother of her own to worry about, Carol said. The anger had gone out of her. She sounded deflated, dispirited. I could remember the laughing girl who had stood beside me, watching the shreds of Goldwater bumper sticker blow away across the macadam. But this didn't seem like the same one. My mother is my mother. There's only Ian and me to take care of her, and Ian's barely making it in high school. Besides, there's always UConn.
You want some information? I asked her. My voice was trembling, thickening.
I'll give you some, whether you want it or not.
Okay?
You're breaking my heart here.
That's the information.
You're breaking my goddamn heart.
I'm not, though, she said. Hearts are tough, Pete. Most times they don't break. Most times they only bend.
Yeah, yeah, and Confucius say women who fly upside down have crack up.
I began to cry. Not a lot, but they were tears, all right. Mostly, I think it was being caught so utterly unprepared. And okay, maybe I was crying for myself as well, because I was scared. I was now flunking, or in danger of flunking, all but a single subject. One of my friends was planning to push the eject button, and I couldn't seem to stop playing cards. Nothing was going the way I had expected it would once I got to college, and I was terrified.
I don't want you to go, I said.
I love you.
Then I tried to smile. Just a little more information, okay?
She looked at me with an expression I couldn't read, then cranked down her window and tossed out her cigarette. She rolled the window back up and held her arms out to me. Come here. I put out my own cigarette in the overflowing ashtray and slipped across to her side of the seat, into her arms. She kissed me, then looked into my eyes. Maybe you love me and maybe you don't. I'd never try to talk anyone out of loving me, I can tell you that much, because there's never enough loving to go around. But you're confused, Pete. About school, about hearts, about Anne-Marie, and about me, too. I started to say I wasn't, but of course I was. I can go to UConn, she said. If my mother shapes up, I will go to UConn. If that doesn't work out, I can take courses part-time at Pennington and Bridgeport, or even CED courses at night in Stratford or Harwich. I can do those things. I have the luxury of doing those things because I'm a girl. This is a good time to be a girl, believe me. Lyndon Johnson has seen to that.
Carol, she put her hand gently against my mouth. If you flunk out this December, you're apt to be in the jungle next December. You need to think about that, Pete. It's one thing for Sully. He thinks it's right, and he wants to go. You don't know what you want or what you think, and you won't as long as you keep running those cards.
Hey, I took the Goldwater sticker off my car, didn't I?
It sounded foolish to my own ears.
She said nothing.
When are you going?
Tomorrow afternoon. I have a ticket on the 4 o'clock Trailways bus to New York. The Harwich stop isn't more than 3 blocks from my front door.
Are you leaving from Derry?
Yes. Can I drive you to the depot? I could pick you up at your dorm around 3.
She considered it, then nodded, but I saw a shaded look in her eyes. It was hard to miss because those eyes were usually so wide and guileless.
That would be good, she said.
Thank you. And I didn't lie to you, did I?
I told you we might be temporary.
I sighed.
Yeah.
Only this was a lot more temporary than I had been expecting.
Now, number 6.